Well, I appreciate you joining us. We got a special guest today, former host of Midwest Whitetail and current host of Hoyt's Bow Hunting Whitetails. Bill, thanks for joining us. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. I appreciate it. I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Good, good. Well, you know, I'd like to have you on later on in the year and we'll talk about actual hunting and deer and food plots and all that good stuff. But I kind of want to like dive into your story today, because I've been like a huge fan of Midwest Whitetail growing up, and I could probably tell you every buck on your wall and the name of it. Like, but I kind of want to how you got started in flipping land, and because it's honestly like kind of like the American dream. Like you and the wife started, you bought into a private equity membership, didn't you?
It was a subchapter S corporation. So it was, I think there were 14 owners at that time. And we had a 3,600 acre contiguous block, and we leased 400 and some acres at Border. So we had over 4,000 acres contiguous. And that was back in the mid 90s in Southern Iowa. So it was an interesting project for sure, but that was my first experience with owning land, was owning a share. And gosh, back then land was so cheap. If only I could have known at that time what I know now, you know, about how to purchase it and how to pay for it, because you could have owned everything you looked at, everything that was for sale, you could have bought back then because it was just so cheap. But anyway, I guess, you know, that's water under the bridge. But
how much was it an acre in Southern Iowa back then?
Well, it was $325.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, for hunting land, because nobody saw any value. You know, back then, recreational land wasn't a category. There was only land, you know, and land was basically valued based on what kind of income you could produce from it. So the farmers looked at the timber ground as being basically useless. And no one knew what a log was worth except the people who were buying them. So it wasn't in their best interest to tell anybody that a walnut tree was worth $400 or whatever, you know, and so nobody really knew. Heck, you could have bought half of Southern Iowa for the price of one, you know, walnut tree per acre. And that's not very many. And anyway, the point is, it was so inexpensive. And I mean, it needed to be for me because we just didn't have hardly any money, really. It was, we had to borrow the money, you know, just to even get started in the first place.
Yeah, you were the property manager for that club, weren't you? And at this time, were you writing articles in the magazine and photography and all this stuff at the same time?
Yeah, that's right. So that was my income, was photography, writing. And, you know, anybody who has done that, I mean, obviously we could get off topic and talk about, you know, the business of writing and photography, but it's not lucrative. It's, you know, you got to work a lot of hours because you're only as good as the next piece that you can write and sell, or the next photo that you can take and sell, you know, and it wasn't like the per piece rate was super high. So you had to get a lot of volume in order to make that work. So it was, I mean, I worked really hard, but it'd be similar to, you know, the average job if you work two jobs, basically. That's about what income, you know, relative during that time that I was making. But I was working, you know, all those extra hours, you know, to do as much of that as I possibly could. Because like I said, the per piece price that you received for an article or a photo wasn't very much.
So you're getting paid per, how many articles a day were you writing?
Oh, more than one. On my best year, I did 320 some articles.
Oh, wow.
So if you figure, you know, you take your Sundays out and you take, you know, a couple months out for the hunting season, you know, you're well over one a day. And if you've ever done it, you don't have the luxury of writer's block when you've got to produce, you know, 1 point some articles a day. You just have to go and grind and, you know, crunch your way through it. But and I wrote for a lot of small magazines too. It wasn't like they were all Outdoor Life or, you know, some big prominent magazine. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that I wrote for Iowa Game and Fish and, you know, smaller stuff too.
Mm-hmm. And then, so getting out of that private equity, were you using a 1031 tax exchange on your first piece of property? And then you just sold that equity membership and you bought your first property.
Yeah. You can't do a 1031 on a share of stock. Okay. So what we owned there was shares of that subchapter S. And when I sold that, you had to pay capital gains, typical of anything else that you might sell that you can't do a tax exchange on. So the only way you could do it, and there's ways to structure LLCs in such a way that you could, sell part of your ownership of land and do a 1031 into more land or, other real estate. But that's not the way the subchapter S's are set up, unfortunately. So anyway, that was the only time I've ever sold land that I had to pay capital gains tax. Every time after that, I was fortunate enough or blessed enough to be able to find the replacement quickly enough or in advance and make my transactions work so that when I sold, I could immediately roll it into the next piece.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I want to tell a story, because it's almost like everything just fell into place. And it's almost like God just making everything, it stacked up all in line for you to build your dream farm.
Oh, for sure. And I've said that many times that, I didn't put that together. God put that together because there were too many pieces that had to fit, too many things that were floating that had to land just right in order for that to work. And, I had people ask me later, why don't you keep doing it? Why didn't you do that again? And I said, well, you don't realize how unique this one was. And it needed to be, when you first start and you don't have any money to begin with, everything needs to work. You can't fumble partway through, on transaction one or two or whatever. You can't fumble because you don't have enough. The ball's not big enough to recover. You got to go all the way back to square one then. Whereas, if you've been doing it for a while, you can make a few mistakes and you can still outrun your mistakes. You really can't hardly make any mistakes when you don't have much and you're gambling at all every time. So it's sort of like, you're not taking your chips off the table. You just keep pushing them, pushing them in, and it has to work. Otherwise, you get set back pretty bad. And like I said, it had to have been a lot of divine intercession into my success on that one, because there were a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, absolutely. How big was that first piece of property you bought? Because I would assume now with land prices where it's at, to do what you did, the first piece of property today would have to be, 40 acres at least to do that?
Yeah, I think 40. Well, it depends on, what kind of money you've got to start with, obviously. But, for the average person, I think they're looking at starting with 40, and then working up from there. It's just going to take longer. You can still do it. You just have to be a lot better at a couple of things than what I had to be, because back then the land was so cheap and it was rising, so consistently because it was so undervalued. I mean, you start at $325 an acre. You can't mess up. Right. I mean, there's no downside, and it stayed like that for quite a while. It wasn't until I got up into the 2000s per acre that I started to even get nervous about buying. It was quickly as I could find an undervalued property and figure out a way to buy it. I was into that and then going forward. But, the dynamics are a lot different now. It can still be done, but you just have to be more careful. You have to be better at recognizing value, and you have to start smaller, obviously. My first property that I owned outright with my name on the deed was 125 acres. And then within 4 years, let me make sure I got that right. No, within 5 or 6 years, that was 1,000 acres. And it was because I was able to find other properties that were undervalued, purchase those, bring them up to value, either let the market do that or make the changes that were necessary, from the standpoint of, improving access, putting in food plots, the various things that take a property that's undervalued and make it more valuable. and then sell it, and then find somebody next to me that was willing to sell. Again, I was like, you couldn't orchestrate that. It just fell into place. So it was, but it was a good learning experience either way. I mean, I don't think I could do it again. I mean, I can do something similar to that, but on a smaller, slower scale, because the timing was perfect back then.
Were you, when you bought a new piece of property, did you log every property? Like as soon as you bought it, you had a forester come out there and everything?
No. Some of them, you know, made sense that way and some of them didn't. You know, people didn't understand the value of the logs back at that time. Nobody was publishing that information. And I had a friend who was a buyer, who was a log buyer for a sawmill. And he took it on himself to, you know, bring me under his wing and teach me everything that he knew, you know, as much as he could, you know, in the amount of time we had. And we spent hundreds and hundreds of hours together where he was teaching me, you know, how to buy, you know, how to sell logs, you know, where you're going to get taken to the cleaners, you know, by somebody who's maybe working under the table, just all the stuff to watch out for. And I'm sure that Mike made me a lot of money and, you know, kept me out of a lot of trouble. So again, I was blessed to have somebody like that, you know, in my camp to walk me through some of this stuff for a while. And so it was a valuable education. And again, that stuff was all available online now. I mean, you might have to do a lot of study and a lot of research, but back then it wasn't, you know, it wasn't that much information published. So you almost had to be taught by a mentor. And most of those people wouldn't do it because it wasn't in their best interest to educate everybody on what stuff was worth. Because, you know, it'd be like you saying, hey, I can buy this cheap, but if I teach you what I'm doing, I'm not going to be able to buy it cheap from you, you know? So why am I teaching people, you know, what I know if all it's going to do is cost me money? But Mike, he did it anyway. So anyway, the point is, again, that was another blessing in the whole process that helped make it all work.
Yeah.
But to answer your question really in a more short version, I would say of the stuff I bought to resell, probably logged half of them. I would say there was, okay, you know, not heavily. There might have been, you know, 100 walnut trees on 175 acres or something like that. You know, it wasn't like you went in there and took out everything that had any value. You only took the cream off the top and then, you know, kept it moving.
Yeah. So, and that was going to be one of my questions is, do you ever regret selling one of the piece of properties? But I know you're probably going to say the farm that you didn't try to kill the 200 before you sold it.
Yeah.
And the Iowa well, property.
And that one, you know, that deer sold that property.
True. Yeah.
And, you know, in hindsight, the amount of money I made on that one, that would have been a pretty expensive deer, you know, if I would have killed it. Because I'm not saying that I couldn't have sold the property anyway, but the person that bought that, the first thing they wanted to do when they came to look at the property was see to verify the camera location, you know, because Rich Baugh, the realtor, was using a picture of that deer as part of the marketing. Well, the potential buyer, he wanted Rich to take him to the spot, you know, where the camera was located so that he could verify that it actually was there. I mean, okay. It was one of those things where he wasn't going to believe it until he actually saw it.
Mm-hmm. And Rich was at Whitetail Properties at the time.
Yeah. Okay. And he still is. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But, and I worked with Rich a lot back then. It's a, you know, we could talk for hours about how that whole system worked and, you know, how the business part of it worked. But again, it's almost like, I won't say it's too late for the formula that we used to work now. Mm-hmm. It's just, there probably has to be a new one and a better one and an evolved one that is more in keeping with the way land changes hands now versus back then, because there was a lot of things that were unsophisticated at that time, because we could find a lot of properties just by driving around to the small towns and going to the local realtors. They didn't even have websites. you know, they have little boards on the wall, you know, that show which land they have listed. And it might be their uncle's, you know, 160-acre old, you know, cattle farm, and they don't think it's worth anything. And, you know, so it was easy to find deals. It was easy to find undervalued property. I mean, you had to look for it, but it was available. You know, now, just the way that information moves and how much more educated everybody is, how much better the marketing is, it's a lot harder to find stuff that's obviously undervalued. Yeah. You know, we could find stuff that was, you know, 40% undervalued. You know, and, you know, Rich Baugh's purpose and all of that was to say, yeah, I mean, I can sell this for X. And you look at it with the local hometown realtors got it listed for, and you're like, wow, you need to buy this. So again, the whole way that the process worked then was different than I think what you would have to do if you're trying to put a machine together to do something similar now. Mm-hmm. Your margins are going to be a lot less.
Yeah.
You might be buying stuff that's 10 or 15% undervalued rather than 25 or 40% undervalued.
Yeah. The sellers are just so much more educated now.
Yeah. And all of the realtors are better.
Yeah.
They're better at it too. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to dive into the island property because it's very intriguing.
You had to
get permission from the Army Corps of Engineers to build a bridge, correct?
No, I didn't have to get permission. That was the interesting part about it, because it had WRP on the island, which grandfathers access for the owner. So there was nothing they could legally do to keep me off the island. So any way that I could realistically figure out how to get there was fair game. And I asked them, you know, do you offer expertise? Like, I need to figure out how to get out there. Can you guys tell me how to do that? And they said, no, we can't help you, but we can't stop you from any means that makes sense to you to get out to that island. So, yeah, again, I mean, where do you start and where do you stop on some of these stories? But that one had a lot of moving parts in its own. I mean, every single one of these projects seems like they were little mini soap operas, but we had to figure out how to get out there. It was about 65, 70 yards across a flowing waterway. It was a little flowage that separated the island from the mainland, but the bulk of the Cedar River went around the other side of the island. So it was like this little spur cut the island off from the mainland. But it's not like you could just drive out there. But there was an old crossing there that had existed who knows how far back. And I don't know how low the river would have to be before you could have driven out on that crossing. But that was how they got out to that island originally when they farmed it. Who knows how many decades back. You know, they'd driven out on some crossing that had long since disappeared. So everybody was telling me you need to build a bridge, or you need to do, you know, put a bunch of duct work in here and fill it up with rock. And I thought, you know, all I need to do is raise the level of this flowage so that it's as high as where the water comes around the island at the upstream end. Because if it's high enough, it's just going to follow the main, you know, the main flow of the river. It's not going to cut through this little flowage. If I make it so that more water goes through there, all I'm going to do is, you know, speed up the flow. Why don't I just build a dam instead of a bridge? So that's what we did. And even, you know, how we built that, you know, everything about it was, that process was unique. But the point is, we ended up building a dam, and that was the crossing that we used. We stopped the flow of water coming around the island on that side. And again, there was nothing the Army Corps of Engineers could do. And I'm sure there was a few local fishermen that, you know, had a funny look on their face when they showed up to fish the lower end of that, you know, and there was no more water coming through.
Yeah.
But it allowed me to get log skidders out there. We harvested a bunch of virgin, it would have been silver maple, soft maple. And there was a sawmill in that area that needed soft maple for some of their big orders that they had with the big company that was purchasing boards from them. So anyway, that one, that's like the the 5% of that story. There's like 95% of the iceberg that's under the water on that story.
But yeah,
that was how that one came together. Yeah. And here's the funny part about that too. So after we got all the timber, we didn't clear cut it either. You know, it's not like you don't really want to clear cut properties if what you're trying to do is resell them eventually. So we just took the best stuff off, and, the stuff that was going to bring the best, price at the mill, and left everything else. So it still looked okay. Well, I sold it. I can't remember how long after we cut it, maybe 9 months or 10 months later. I was going to hold it longer. In fact, I was going to turn the WRP into a waterfall area. Like they said, yeah, you can build water structures in there. You can put pumps in there. You can flood it if you want to. I thought this would be really cool. I'll turn this island into like this waterfall paradise, and then I'll sell it later someday as a waterfall property.
Yeah.
Well, somebody came along that wanted to buy it. So I kind of pushed my hand, and there was a piece of property that bordered me on the main farm that the guy said he was willing to sell at roughly the same time. So it was like the whole thing got pushed forward. Well, it closed that sale when I sold it. That closed during one of the biggest floods in the history of central Iowa. I think there was like 8 feet of water going over the top of the island when that sale closed. Well, I was like, wow, I'm so lucky I got this done. The irony is that FEMA came in a few months after that, after water dropped. And people who know Iowa, they know that the Cedar River flooded Cedar Rapids, and it flooded a lot of areas, and FEMA became very active saying, hey, we don't need people building in these floodplains. Let's figure out how to eliminate that. So they bought conservation easements, or whatever you call those, a development easement on everything that they could get all the way down the Cedar Valley. And they ended up buying the easement, the construction or development easement to that island from the people that I sold it to for way more than they paid me for it. So they got not only to keep the island, but FEMA paid them more than what they paid for the land. So they made money and got to keep the property. It was still in their name. They could never develop it, but who's going to develop it anyway? So right, it's what a drama. Like I said, I mean, I'm sure we could. It's only interesting to people who are land geeks.
Oh yeah,
because I'm sure a lot of people would say, well, I've already lost interest in what Bill is talking about. But it was so interesting to see every chapter of that project of putting that big farm together and how unique each chapter of it was. And it goes back to the thing about, well, this had to have been, God's hand in this, because there was too many pieces that fell into place. And that's one reason why I've never tried to reconstruct. I would be arrogant to pretend I could do it again, because there was just everything was in my favor. It just kept landing in my lap.
Right. Yeah. And that's why I wanted to, because everybody obviously knows Midwest Whitetail and the double G four bucket and all this stuff, but how you got to Midwest Whitetail, you've wrote stuff on your website and books and stuff, but it's just such a fascinating story of how, really, like I said, the American dream of how you started from nothing and built your way up to that point. And when you sold the island property, did you more transition to the home farm? Was that when you bought the home farm?
Yeah.
So you went from the island to the home farm.
Adding more to it.
Okay.
Just adding more. Yeah. It was because I could continue to find sellers that bordered me, because you got to figure I started at 125 acres. It took 9 total transactions to turn that into 1,000 acres. And, so none of those took place with a realtor, which I thought was also interesting. All my neighbors just sold to me, without the use of a realtor.
Yeah, and that's another thing. You ain't got to do that today.
No. And what I did though, in my favor there was I just offered anybody 10% over the market price. So I just figured, what is the market price? I'll just give you 10% over that. And that usually was enough to keep them from, worrying too much about whether I was getting too good of a deal, because clearly I was overpaying. So that sort of smoothed it out some too. And I think they talk, and I was fair enough with people. Then you get your neighbors talking to your other neighbors, and it just sort of snowballed. Mm-hmm. But I could have kept buying. If I would have kept buying, By the time I sold that property in 2019, I could have had 2,500 acres contiguous right there. That's how much changed hands during the 19 years that I was in that neighborhood. I quit at 1,000 because, you know, financially, obviously, you know, you got to figure out how to pay for it, but also it's a lot of work. You know, if I'd had much more land, I would have just had to be sort of like hands off and just say, well, it is what it is. You know, I can't make it better. I just don't have time. So if it's not good already, then it's never going to be good because there's not enough time in the day for me to get around and fine tune and micromanage that much land.
Mm-hmm. At what point in this process, you brought in Larry Kindle at one point, didn't you? And you guys kind of went in on some properties together.
Yes. That was in the middle of when I was putting my big piece together. And Larry was an interesting story too, because he was an entrepreneur, you know, from the word go as a young man. And he started a lot of small companies and built them into medium-sized companies and sold them. And he sort of had a real talent for that. So he had some capital to work with. And I had the ambition and, you know, at least at first I had knowledge. You know, Larry caught up really fast on the knowledge side of it, but he had the capital. So he didn't own anything on my farm, like the what you'd call my home place. But he was the money man behind some of the properties that we found that were undervalued, you know, off in the fringes, you know, like different places where you say, well, gosh, how do you do this bigger? I mean, I can see 20 undervalued properties right now, and I'm looking around on the internet and I'm driving around and going to these realtors. I mean, I can't even begin to touch these. You know, I can buy the most obvious ones myself, but, you know, how do you ramp that up? And that's where Larry came in. So we partnered on additional properties. And, you know, unfortunately for me, the way that that all came together was I'm not on the deed. So then when those sold, you know, my part of the selling price became a consulting fee, which became regular income. So it was taxed differently. So I couldn't really do like 1031s on the stuff that basically Larry owned that, you know, I helped him, you know, to put together. So that brought different challenges into the whole financial, side of things too. And you know, we could talk about that at some length. I mean, obviously, it was a lifetime of lessons in about, you know, 4 or 5 years that it was just full speed ahead. And but that's where Larry factored into it. And, you know, Larry ended up during the time when I lived in that area, he ended up founding Muddy Outdoors, the tree stand company, which is still in existence, mm-hmm. Bloodsport Arrows, which is still in existence. Larry founded those just down the road a little ways from where I lived. And he sold both of those companies. And, you know, so he was also, you know, during that time becoming more involved in the hunting industry. So it was just sort of a, you know, I worked with them quite a bit as sponsors for Midwest Whitetail during that time. So that was kind of how, you know, how Larry fit into the whole thing.
Yeah. And when you started Midwest Whitetail, it was 2008, right?
Yeah.
Did you already have your full piece at the home farm?
Yes.
Okay.
Gotcha. I think 2008. Yes. 2008, I think, is when I bought the last piece. I don't think I bought anything after that. You know, maybe that was 2009 when that final sale took place or the final purchase. But I never bought anything after that. Then from then on, Midwest Whitetail was the little engine that could that helped me to pay for all that stuff. You know, to try to figure out how to, you know, I could wheel and deal my way with the bank, and you know, I could get the loans, but you got to still figure out how to pay them. You know, how to pay for them, and so Midwest Whitetail was more, I won't call it a panic mission, but now I had all this land and I've got to figure out how to pay for it. And during that time, the writing business was starting to decline because the internet was picking up more and more of the advertising money that people were spending, the companies were spending. Television was picking up more and more of that advertising money. So less and less of it was going to print. So where I was making my primary income was starting to dry up. So that's what motivated me to get out of my comfort zone. And that's where Midwest Whitetail came from. It was more, I wouldn't say I necessarily had a passion for doing it. I liked writing and I tolerated photography, but I didn't necessarily love videography. You know, I didn't mind filming. I just didn't like being in front of the camera. You know, it got on my nerves and you know, it still kind of does, to be honest with you. You know, it's just some people love being in front of the camera. I just kind of want to be left alone. You know, I want to go get in my tree and sit there, you know, and enjoy the day. And if a deer comes by, great. But you don't have that luxury when you've got the camera with you. You're constantly having to produce content. You have to have something, you know, for the viewer, because that's what you do for a living now. So it changed. It didn't change my love of hunting. It just changed, you know, the level of relaxation that I got out of it. You know, and again, I wouldn't have done it if I didn't have to. Right. I would have kept writing. I think I would have just written that, you know, that one, you know, further.
Yeah, it's kind of a double-edged thing, because at that time there was no like semi-live hunting content like there is now. Like that was the first. Yeah. I mean, every Monday you released the episode of the week before, and it was like every week, like, let's see if he killed the G4 buck last week. It was like the first of its kind. But going back to the filming aspect and how you kind of got burnt out on it, you know, if it wasn't for having to get content and film, you would have killed the G4 buck way faster than you did, because you had put this box blind in the food plot to get good content of killing this deer, where if you weren't filming and having to hide a cameraman, you would have killed him a lot sooner, I'm assuming.
Yeah, and, you know, I never have actually sat down and tried to figure out how many bucks the camera has cost me, but it's probably not quite as many as what people think. You know, what it does is it changes your flexibility, like where you can hunt, which does limit your capability or your, I won't say mobility, but your options get limited, because, you know, it's not twice as hard to hunt with a cameraman. It's like four times as hard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I took 2020 and 2021 and just hunted by myself after all those years, you know, of hunting with a cameraman. It felt like, you know, I was a whole different person.
You're kidding. You know, found your love again. Yeah.
Well, it's like you're a bird and you realize, hey, I can actually fly, you know, where I don't have to walk around, you know, all the time. I can actually fly. And that's because you have to have so many considerations of content and the filming angles of putting two people in a tree. How do you hide two people? You know, some people, they aren't very good at climbing, you know, so you got to hunt out of blinds more. Some people aren't very good at, you know, you name it, you know, the cameraman. And, you know, you're constantly trying to figure out, you know, how do we set up so that we don't get busted, you know, every single time a deer walks by. So anyway, the point is, I don't know that it specifically cost me a lot of deer where a deer looked up, saw the cameraman and blew, but more it limited how aggressively you could hunt in some cases. And, you know, some of the options that you had where you could set up, which might have been better than some of the places that you ended up having to hunt.
Right. Would you say 2011 was the best year on the farm?
Yeah.
That was the year you killed G5, correct?
Yeah. And I hit we call him the G4 buck, that big one. And I hit him January 1st or 2nd of 12. So it would have been the same hunting season. So that year, between myself and the two kids, I think we killed a 160, a 170, a 180, a 190, and I hit and lost a 200. And that wasn't even all of the big deer. I mean, there were a lot of other ones that you look at now and you'd say, oh man, that thing is a giant. Didn't even hunt them. You know, didn't even think about hunting them because there were so many other bucks to go after. So it was, I don't know if it's the best, if it was the best farm in the country at that time, it might've been. You know, I'm sure there are some now that are better than what that farm was in 2011, but not by much.
Yeah.
You know, it was really, really good.
It would take some strong arguments to persuade me it wasn't the best farm in the country. Cause I remember one episode where you had just like left out of the office and hopped in the stand like 100 yards off your back porch. And I think that's when you killed Jamie, like just right off the back porch.
Yeah. And that was one of the best spots on the farm. It was just 100 yards from the house. It was just a little narrow spot where the deer crossed the road between our yard and a big open field. Well, you know, as long as we weren't messing around in there, which we weren't, they were used to, on a prevailing west wind, the smell of people coming from our house. You know, so when I went in there and set up, as long as I did some level of scent control, they could still smell me, but it didn't register to them as danger because they were so used to smelling people because they were just passing downwind of the house all the time. Well, that made it a super easy spot to hunt because you got away with a lot more. Plus, it was such a natural funnel that they were using it quite a bit too. And I had a 190 plus buck in there one time, and you know, didn't get a shot at him, didn't get any video, but I know which deer it was because we found the sheds off him, and he was, you know, well over 190, just sneaking past. Well, there was multiple bucks like that that kind of lived and passed through that little neck of timber right next to the house on Giants.
Was Bubba right behind your house? Where was that one at?
No, he was quite a ways away. Okay. He was probably a mile and a half or so from the house. Yeah. But yep. There was other, I mean, the G4 buck lived, not the G4 buck. There was one that got away. I hit him in 2004, I think. I hit this buck, giant, 200 plus inch, 225 plus inch. He was just a 4-year-old deer. And I hit him high. I'm sure he dropped, you know, another long story, but I saw him 5 or 6 days later, and he looked fine. You know, he didn't seem any worse for wear, but the neighbors found him dead that winter. And, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, the dad said, yeah, you know, the kids jumped the fence and went and grabbed him. And I'm like, oh, that's not good. You know, because legally that deer then belongs to whoever's land he's laying dead on. That's the Iowa law. I thought, okay. You know, what am I going to do now? You know, so I just kind of let it slide, but I could have blown up the neighborhood over that one, you know, and just said, okay, well, I'm going to call the game warden. That deer's mine. But I just kind of let it slide. But anyway, that was a giant that broke my heart, but that was living right on the edge of the yard. That deer was, I could see him out the back window, you know, like sitting in the yard, in the you know, back of the house. I could watch out there in that direction. I could see him, you know, every now and again. And there was a giant 5x5, and I swear it was 190-inch clean net typical. He would come out during the summer right below the yard into a little alfalfa field, you know, 75, 80 yards from the house. And that's where we found his shed. You know, it's like, I've got the shed off him, 92 inches, 5-point side, you know, just gigantic deer. And they were fairly common back then. You know, not like every year you're going to have, you know, 200-inch deer, but you're going to have 180-plus-inch deer every year.
Yeah, and that was peak Southern Iowa.
That's pretty unbelievable. And the reason is the hunting pressure around there wasn't focused on bucks. That's all. The bucks were getting old. There was no other magic to it. You know, some of the stuff that we did on the farm helped, you know, as far as habitat improvements, allowed us maybe to hold a higher density of mature bucks on the property. But the reason there were deer that big in that area is because people weren't shooting them when they were young. It just didn't, the tradition wasn't there of people deer hunting to begin with. And they certainly weren't trophy hunting. You know, they were just, if anything, they were just going out and shooting whatever ran past. And, you know, that wasn't hurting anything. You know, you kill the odd 2-year-old, you know, that's not going to make any difference in the grand scheme of things. You know, but when you start genetically culling, taking the highest quality genetics out because they look big and they're easy to kill, you know, because they're young. And now you start quote unquote trophy hunting. Well, that's when things started to go downhill. And that's when, that's usually one of the things that breaks the back of any management area, is people think that deer management is actually trophy hunting, and they're completely different. Trophy hunting and deer management aren't the same thing.
Yeah.
But they kind of get lumped together but anyway, I'm getting off topic.
No, I agree. I feel like social media ruined that. Like killing a 200-inch deer isn't the same as back then where it was a huge deal. And then now on social media, you still see it all the time of 190 plus inch deer getting killed. And it's kind of ruined the trophy hunting aspect. And that's what I've always respected about you is I feel like killing Loppy made you just as happy as killing the double D four buck.
We laughed so hard, Drew Yarkoski and myself. I mean, to this day, that would be maybe the most fun reaction that I've ever had, because that deer was a ghost. He was, and it was kind of a funny one too, because Chad Lathrop wanted to kill that deer so bad when he was filming for me. I used to let the cameraman carry his bow, you know, because there were deer on the farm that I wasn't going to shoot. I thought, yeah, what the heck, you know, you can swing the camera over to me and I'll film you shooting it. Mm-hmm. Well, Chad wanted that buck so bad. And every time we saw Loppy, he'd get all excited. You know, we'd try to grind him in and kill him. And finally, it's like 2 or 3 years later that I finally killed that deer. And of course, Drew Yarkoski, he knew the whole story, you know, the relationship that we'd had with that deer over the years. So it was just kind of a cool experience to share that with Drew. And because he really appreciated that deer as much as I did, because he'd been along for that whole journey too. He was an intern, quote unquote intern at Midwest Whitetail in 2008 when I started. He was a college kid and he would come down on the weekends and help me edit. We just didn't know anything, you know, and Drew kind of got his start with me, and he went on to be one of the best editors in the whole hunting industry by far. I mean, he was doing all the Heartland bow hunter stuff for quite a while, and you know how high end that is.
Oh yeah.
But anyway, Drew started out as a college kid coming down to my little office on the weekends, editing Midwest Whitetail episodes.
Yeah. That's just growing up. I feel like that was the perfect scenario. You're on a farm in Southern Iowa and like the Mecca whitetail country. It's just you, your family, you're growing a business, and it was just perfect. And that time frame from probably like 2008 to 2014 was probably the best hunting content that I've ever seen and probably won't be able to replicate. You just had so many older deer. You had Loppy, you had G4, G5, you had, I mean, even before that, you had a buck called Survivor that you had killed, I think, the same morning you saw the G4 buck.
Yes, that's just right.
Stuff like that. You had an old buck that I don't even know if it ever got killed, but it was a really cool buck called Flash Gordon. And he had like these flyers coming off his G2.
Yeah, he never killed that deer. He disappeared on us. But yeah, he was one that, again, he wouldn't have scored anything, but we wanted that deer so bad just because of how old and crusty he was. You could tell that he was just a bag of bones. You know, I mean, he was, who knows how old that deer was, you know, he might've been 12, you know, who knows. But anyway, he had his G2 had like 4 sticker points or 5 sticker points going off the back. So it was almost like, you know, we called him Flash Gordon because it was like the, you know, like the Flash Gordon, you know, logo or emblem or whatever, you know, with the, you know, the fire or whatever it is coming off his, you know, anyway, the point is he had this persona that had nothing to do with his score. Right. They were just cool deer.
How far was that food plot you killed Loppy at from where you killed G4 buck? The two separate sides of the farm. Way.
Yeah, I'd say it was a mile, probably at least, maybe more, mile and a half. Because the farm wasn't a square or a circle. It was kind of like a big semicircle or an arc.
Okay.
You know, so one end to the other end was quite a ways, but it might not have been real thick, you know, the whole way through. It was maybe narrower, but longer. So I covered a lot of ground, you know, with that same number of acres compared to had it all been one, you know, like clean block.
Well, let's talk about the G4 buck because it's probably the buck that got me into bow hunting. You know, my dad got me into hunting, but that's the buck that I really wanted to get into bow hunting and stuff. And talk about that journey, because it was a journey. It was several, 4 or 5 years of hunting this deer. And you had built a box blind and put it in this food plot. And that's when you made that high hit and you were like, I'm done with this box blind. You got it out of there. It was just so many things as a story. But I feel like people don't talk about is after you kill the deer. Because the farm, you've chased that deer for so long, the farm had to have felt empty. And you're like, what am I going to do now?
Yeah. And that was, you know, that was kind of the conclusion that I came to after I killed him. It wasn't, you know, obviously at the moment of the shot, you're pretty excited because you're like, wow, you know, we finally cashed this in, you know, we got this deer. But then when you recover the deer and you realize that now I don't get to hunt this deer anymore, you know, that's when it kind of hits you. Because, you know, I'm not saying that that it changes hunting. It doesn't really change hunting, but it had become so wrapped or so focused on that one deer that now that he was gone, it was like, okay, what gets me up? You know, what gets me out of bed at 4:30 in the morning to get into a tree now? You know, it was always this deer for three seasons. He's why I got out of bed, you know, and so what's it going to be now? I mean, what motivates me? And, you know, of course, you know, you come back around to just love hunting and you find other bucks to hunt. But the first initial reaction after killing it was, I won't say sadness, you know, but on some level, maybe like a little bit of, like you said, an emptiness that the deer wasn't there to hunt anymore.
Yeah. And I mean, after you killed G5, you still had to go after G4. So it didn't mean as much after you killed G5. Right. But G5, in my opinion, is really underrated deer, because you had in that afternoon, that buck pushed away the G4 buck.
Oh yeah. He was the G5 buck. When I sent the teeth in to get him sectioned and aged, he was only 4. So that buck had so much upside. And, you know, had I known he was 4, I don't know that I would have passed him up, you know, but I thought he was 5, you know, and I'm not saying that age is, you know, is everything. If they're not 5, you know, they're not worth shooting. That's not really the point, but the farm was, you know, there wasn't that much pressure around me. The farm was big enough, you know, even though it was a little bit narrow and I had a lot of neighbors, it just didn't, the dynamics in that area, they weren't killing a lot of the bucks. People weren't shooting a lot of the bucks that were in and on and off my property. So there's a pretty good chance that if I let them go, that they wouldn't get killed. So it would have been an interesting, you know, experience, I guess, to see what that deer could have turned into had I not shot him, because that's a really big 4-year-old, you know,
giant.
I don't know why we never really did truly score that deer, but, you know, he was 190, let's say, you know, but he was, he had all the makings of, you know, a lot bigger deer, you know, if he could have got a couple more years. But, you know, again, like I said, had I known he was 4, I'm not sure that I would have changed what I did. I don't know. But he was fairly young, you know, and in the world of really high scoring or big antler deer, he would have been on the young side.
Yeah. It's not like that's the first time you've seen that deer. You passed that deer. That deer was very daylight active as a 3-year-old that you passed.
Well, I tried to kill him as a 3-year-old.
Oh, did you?
I thought he was 4. Yeah. I was trying to kill him. And in fact, Jared Mills was working for me back then, and he was filming me one evening, and we had him at 25 yards behind the stand. And it was late season, and when I turned, the stand creaked, because sometimes they'll do that when it gets really cold, you know, like they squeak against the tree or whatever it might be. He locked up and turned and ran off. But I was trying to kill him because I had all these trail cam pictures of him as a 3-year-old, and I thought he was 4. And we had a bunch of encounters with him when he was 2, and I thought he was 3. So I was off by 1 year the whole way. But, you know, it was, that's fairly common. It seems like, you know, some of those deer, their genetics are unique, because not only do they have big antlers, but they have big bodies for their age. So it's easy to misjudge how old they are by a year, because they're just big bodied young bucks with big antlers as young bucks. And so it kind of messes you up, because there's still deer like that on my farm now, and I don't know how old they are, even though I've watched them for 2 or 3 years. It's like, I don't know if he's a big 3-year-old or a small 4-year-old. You know, it's like, but that's what that deer was. He was a really big bodied, big antlered, younger deer.
Yeah, it's probably geographical too. I feel like our deer in Western Kentucky are a little bit smaller in Southern Iowa, just because there's way more ag in Southern Iowa. So that could probably determine the age as well.
It might be the subspecies too, because I think we have the Dakota. I don't think you guys do. I think you got the Virginia maybe.
Yes.
I'm not 100% sure, but the Dakota typically run bigger in body size, not necessarily antlers, but I think, you know, to some degree, the antler size too. But for sure, that Dakota is the bigger body deer. But not all of them are. Again, it's genetic. It's like not all people are big. You know, some are smaller and some are bigger, you know, and the deer are like that too.
Yeah. And going back to that time frame from like 08 to 15, you know, you had mentioned just the genetics in that area being crazy. And I don't know if it's the doe management you guys were on, you were strict on your buck to doe ratio. You had a lot of food, but you just killed so many deer that we don't even mention, like daggers. That's another giant.
I
mean,
there's another 4-year old, another young buck.
Yeah. I mean, just the genetics in that area was just crazy. And, and I think I was either reading the book about, you know, your story flipping land or a podcast or something, but you had said you were looking in a field with a spotting scope or just binoculars in general, maybe the summertime over beans. And there were, what was there, like 10 deer over 160 just in that
getting area. In the sun here. But yeah, I mean, I think that was before I started buying some of that. I remember Larry Zock, he's a wildlife artist in Iowa, and he was parked along the road glassing a field. And I said, Larry, because it bordered my farm and I wanted to buy it. I said, Larry, knock it off, you know, because people are going to see you parked there. They're going to try to figure out what it is that you're looking at. But there was a ridge of soybeans going back into some timber. And you could see if you parked in just the right spot along the road. And there was just giants back in there. I mean, just a whole herd of them, like 10 of them. And like you said, the smallest one in the bunch was like 160 inch 8-pointer. It's like, wow. And there was a 200, way over 200 inch deer in that bunch. And I mean, that was early. That was as I was putting it together, you know, before the Midwest whitetail days. And again, it had to do with the number of bucks that were being shot. People weren't shooting them. They weren't targeting them. There was more of them being poached, you know, trophies being poached than there were being shot legally, because people just didn't care that much. It wasn't in the culture yet. It wasn't like antlers meant much. It was more like, hey, I got to shoot a deer, throw him in the freezer, let's move on to whatever, you know, something else. It wasn't in that area. It wasn't a big deal. And then it became a big deal, you know, over time. But that was before that. And there was a lot of big deer. I'm going to see if I can get out of the sun here. Hold on.
Okay. But yeah, let's go back to, let's talk about the G4 buck a little bit. Cause you'd been hunting that deer for 4 or 5 years. You finally killed him. Where was Death Ridge from where you killed him on that food plot? Was it right down the,
yeah, it was Death Ridge was a secondary ridge off that food plot, which was the main ridge. So the main ridge was soybeans, I think that year. And I don't think it really grew, and we ended up putting brassicas in there in parts of it. And then, you know, we always battled with getting stuff to grow because we had a number of droughts and the deer density was pretty high. You know, so it was always a struggle, you know, trying to get stuff to really flourish. Whereas it's just the opposite on the farm I own now. It's like, you know, we got way too much, not way too much food, but we got so much food that it's almost ridiculous. But we always battled that. I always struggled, you know, trying to keep up with the number of deer. But anyway, that ridge, I think, was planted to beans, and they just ate it to the dirt. That primary ridge was the food plot, and then there was a number of little secondary ridges that went off it, and Death Ridge was one of those little secondaries.
Yeah, I think you said when you killed him, and I could be wrong, his home range when you killed him had shrunk down to like 30 acres or something.
Yeah, that's about right. And I really believe that, you know, because I had cameras outside of that area and I never picked him up on anything. But if I went into the middle of that area with a camera, and I didn't have any cell cameras, it was before cell cameras, you know, so I didn't go into the middle of his core very often. But every time I went in there to pull the cards out of the camera, he'd be out there every single day, you know, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning, crisscrossing around down in that, you know, in the middle of that core area. And I didn't hunt him there because it was sort of a valley and I didn't want to deal with the swirling wind. So I hunted him on the fringe. And I figured I can hunt him every day of the season if I don't get too aggressive. So that was what, you know, kind of dictated that strategy. But yeah, he was very daylight active toward the end. He lived in a really small area. So, I mean, what more could you ask for? You know, a buck that's moving all the time during the day that lives in a small area. It's pretty easy to hunt.
That's probably why that made that buck so special, is because he was so daylight active and you'd come close so many times and couldn't get it done. And then you finally got it done. But that's probably why you got rid of that box blind, because being in that box blind with the cameraman, you were so confined to get a shot.
Well, and the way we constructed that box blind made it bad, because we made the windows small, thinking that we would keep it more airtight, you know, so that we could keep the scent inside by having smaller windows. Well, the problem with that is you don't really have much flexibility when the deer's moving. You know, like if you stand still, you're fine. You can get your window open, you know, a little small window, you know, nothing very big at all, about the size of a, you know, a piece of writing paper. Well, if he moves at all, now you got to jump to the next one. If he moves through that one, you got to jump to the next one. Well, you're constantly in a panic and you're trying to get the right window open and do it without making a bunch of noise when the deer is 25 yards away moving past the blind. It was just a fiasco. Had we designed the windows differently, I think it would have been okay. But we just, you know, it was the first attempt at making a box blind. And since then, I've just abandoned any thought of making my own. I just get the redneck blind and don't have to worry about it.
I always wanted to ask you why you had made a blind instead of putting a redneck on a trailer in there. Like, I didn't know
you didn't have rednecks
at the time.
No. Had we had one, we'd have definitely done that, because, you know, that was about when redneck got started. You know, it was about the time we were hunting that deer. You know, and that company's not real old. I think we got some of the early blinds, and that would have been in 2013. So they haven't been around for a really long time. So it was kind of right before the fabricated blinds became common.
Yeah. Cause that would have been, Drew had killed a giant over beans with a muzzleloader out of a ground blind. What year was that? That was a buck called, was it Flyers?
Yeah. That would have been 2011 too.
Yeah. That's another giant that we didn't even mention, that just goes under the radar of how great that farm was.
Yeah.
They were
all over the place. Deer like that. You lose track of them. You didn't even hunt them. You don't even pay attention to them because you've got two or three that you're really after. And there might've been six or eight others that were giants that you just sort of, you know, ignored because they just weren't the ones that you were hunting.
Yeah. And you'd had like this, it might've been over the same food plot you killed a lot yet. Like this old barn you guys would hunt out of sometimes with a muzzleloader.
Nope. That was on the other end of the farm. Yep, okay. It was a log cabin that, the people who I bought it from, they actually built it. It looks like the Indians built it or something, or the frontiersmen, you know, but it looked like it was as old as, you know, the ground itself. But the people who I bought that part of the farm from had built that one summer with their family as a project. They built a log cabin, which was pretty cool. So we used it as a big hunting blind, but that was a different part of the farm.
Yeah. Well, let's fast forward a little bit, kind of toward the end. You had kind of transitioned out of Midwest Whitetail. Was it 2019?
Yeah.
What was like the factoring decision in that? Was it just burnout on filming hunts and kind of want to go back to what you did as a kid in bluff country and stuff?
Yeah. And I think I don't want to sound, you know, like sour grapes or anything, but the business of hunting isn't nearly as much fun as hunting.
Right.
Everybody thinks that, oh, he's hunting for a living. Well, you're not hunting for a living. You're doing business for a living. And there aren't too many, unless you just love the business part of it, there aren't too many businesses that are just a barrel of fun. So it was tough trying to keep all the pieces moving in the right direction. You know, there was a lot of employees, a lot of pro staff, a lot of sponsors, a lot of interaction. You know, I'd spend a couple hours a day just answering questions from viewers, you know, a couple hours a day. People think, oh, that's only 2 hours. Yeah, but that's on top of hunting. That's on top of my family. That's on top of managing my business. You know, that's on top of, you know, keeping my pro staff happy and my sponsors happy, et cetera, et cetera. So after a while, it's like, you know, it just wasn't any fun.
Right.
It didn't mean that hunting wasn't fun. It was just all the other stuff that went with trying to make a living out of hunting, which isn't truly something that people would normally say is a business. It'd be different if you were a golf course superintendent, for example, because that's pretty well structured and you just go to work and you know what your job is. And it might be stressful at times, but you can figure out, you know, I can hire people that know how to do this. You know, I can get somebody with a degree in agronomy and et cetera, et cetera. But when you're creating this little business out of hunting, it's sort of like, you know, there's no script. There's no place you can go to find that next person. If somebody leaves, you got to create a new replacement out of thin air. You've got to take an intern and you know, micromanage or you know, teach that person everything that they need to know in order to step into that role. You can't hire somebody to do what we did.
Right.
So anyway, the point is, it just got to be labor intensive. And I'm not saying that somebody else couldn't have done it, kept it going. I just wasn't the guy for the job after a while. It's like, I just don't even want to do this anymore.
You know,
and because I'd look at a tree stand and I'd put one stand up and I'd be on the ground getting ready to put the second stand up. And I'm like, I had to force myself, like almost like personal gunpoint, to put that second stand up. Because I wanted so badly just to take that stand back to my truck or to pitch it into a ditch someplace and just go sit in that tree by myself with no cameraman, no concerns. So that's when I knew it was time to move on and hand it off to somebody who had more passion for it. I like helping people. You know, I like the teaching part of it because that's what the writing was all about. You know, that was more about trying to help people, you know, understand the craft. And it was fun, you know, satisfying to do that. So that part of it is a lot of fun, but there's a lot of little stuff that goes on behind the scenes that people don't realize when you're trying to make a business out of what other people would call a hobby.
Right.
I'm not trying to, you know, get sympathy from anybody, but that's just the reality. But it was, and I eventually got burned out doing that.
Yeah. And I mean, it probably made it a little bit harder because I would imagine the hunting public guys were probably in line to take that over and they decided to go out and start their own brand, which they've done extremely well with. And you almost feel like a proud dad at that moment, but they were probably your backup plan to take over Midwest Whitetail.
Oh yeah, for sure. And you know, that we'd had that conversation and, you know, it was, I don't know, I'm sure I could have done things differently. You know, in hindsight, you know, but now I worked with those guys, you know, maybe I could have given them more freedom or something. I don't know. I mean, I felt like that, I don't know, who knows? I'm not going to second guess what happened. If it was in their best interest to move on and do their own thing, there's no doubt about that. And, you know, could I have figured out some way to keep them? I don't know. You know, but it worked out well for them. I knew they were too good at what they did to work for me forever. So I was trying to figure out, okay, how do I motivate them within the structure of Midwest Whitetail? So we were going to do our own public land series. It was basically going to be Aaron's baby. And, you know, in the process of him sort of looking at what I was laying out, he thought, well, why should I do this here? You know, I can just do this by myself if we're starting from scratch with the public land series. Why don't I just do it? And, you know, I couldn't talk him out of it. You know, I didn't try too hard, you know, but he's right. You know, so that's really what it boiled down to, was they were worth more to themselves than what I could afford to pay them, put it that way. And I think the freedom that they had to do what they wanted to do, you know, to express their own way, spin on stuff. I think they felt like I had my structure. This is the way I do things because, you know, my own personality or however, you know, maybe I was more of a limitation to their creativity than maybe what I should have been, put it that way. Because anyway, you know, I don't have any regrets on, you know, exactly how that all went down. I wanted them to stay. I wanted them to run the business and eventually to own it, but it was just not meant to be.
Yeah, it probably put you in a tough spot because, you know, you obviously wanted to keep them, but, you know, your sponsors were probably in your ear like, this isn't really our clientele. We don't sell redneck blinds to public hunters, you know. So yeah, it probably put you in a tough spot.
Well, that's why we were going to have two different series. That's why we were going to keep Midwest Whitetail more or less the way that it was. And then we were going to start a second series called Public Whitetails. And that was going to be Aaron's baby. And I was just going to be more like hands off, like go for it. We'll figure out, you know, how to make money off this, you know, once we get it rolling, but, you know, make it happen. And that was that fork in the road where, you know, he looked at that and thought, well, if we're doing this from scratch, you know, why don't I just go do it myself? And right. I didn't have a good reason why he shouldn't, because he should, you know, I mean, not everybody's meant to be self-employed, but he obviously was.
Right. And it's not just him. I mean, Jared Mills has built a successful YouTube channel. I mean, his content, his editing is one of the best in the industry. It's just like a lineage of people from Midwest Whitetail that have gone to do their own thing.
I think it was because I didn't really know what I was doing, so I couldn't really tell my editors what to do. So they had a lot of freedom, and they evolved into a lot better editors than I think they would have been if I would have been, you know, standing over them all the time and putting my thumb on them. You know, the only thing I required was early on, they had to spend 2 hours a day. There were some online tutorials back then. Now, of course, there's everything you possibly want to learn on YouTube, but back then it wasn't. So I actually subscribed to a company that had these online tutorials, you know, that could teach you the skills required to operate, you know, After Effects, Premiere Pro, Photoshop, Adobe Illustrator, etc. So my thing was, you guys spend 2 hours a day improving your skills, because, you know, the better skilled you guys are, the better you understand these tools, the more creative you're going to be and so forth. But I didn't know enough about it myself to tell them what they needed to do. So they got really good at it, just kind of like, almost like within their little circle.
Yeah. I always wondered, the internship program that you guys did was essentially like the opportunity of a lifetime. If you're wanting to be a filmmaker or an editor in the hunting industry, whenever you get an intern, did you have like living quarters in your office where they would live and you would be like, when I'm hunting, you better be out there with me? Or like, how does that work?
No, I rented a house in town. I keep popping into the sun here. I'm going to let me move.
Okay.
Maybe this is a little bit better.
Yeah, you're good.
Trying not to. Gosh, that's. I'm sitting in my office and the sun just beats down in here. I'm going to find, maybe I'll go this direction. Maybe I'm going the wrong way. Show you some more deer in behind me here, I guess.
Oh yeah, there you go. That's good.
but so I had a house that I rented in town, and they would stay there. That was the one thing that I provided. You know, I didn't buy their food, but I made sure that they could live for free. So we'd have as many as four, maybe we had five 1 year interns. And the whole goal there, and, you know, interns are a double-edged sword because they don't know anything usually when they start. I mean, they have ambition. You know, we would try to pick people who seemed like they were going to be hard workers, but because again, it was very rare to find somebody who already knew how to do this because nobody knew how to do it, you know, back then. And so we're always starting with a, you know, a lump of clay and trying to make it into something. And so you ended up putting a lot of time and hours into your interns. But my thought was, you know, Midwest Whitetail continues to grow. I'm going to hire one every year. So it's almost like you try it before you buy it. You know, you'd have these three or four, maybe even five candidates that you get to see for, you know, 5 months, maybe, or whatever the length of the internship was. So you didn't have to guess when you were hiring people. You could just hire the best interns every year. So it did help from that standpoint, but it was a lot of work, you know, bringing those guys up to speed. And, you know, Aaron and Greg and some of the guys in the office did quite a bit of that, you know, but at the end of the day, it was still my company. So if the interns weren't doing a good job, people pointed their finger at me, and I didn't like that. You know, so at a certain point, I kind of wanted to terminate the intern projects, because you'd get inexperienced guys and they'd put a hunt together wrong, or they would do something and we'd get badly criticized for it. And we were doing so many shows with all the regional series and so forth that I couldn't really keep up on every little thing, you know. And so once in a while, it kind of drove me crazy. or they'd be filming and, you know, they just didn't quite get the footage, you know, or it was out of focus or whatever it was. And, you know, they were just kids, you know, they just, right. Some of them were still in college. Most of them were graduated seniors, because we like the graduated seniors, because as soon as they graduated from our program, they could get a job working in the industry. They didn't have to go back to school, but you know, that means they were anywhere from 20 to 22 years old. And they just didn't have a lot of experience of any real, you know, usefulness. So the stuff that we got at first was always not very good. So it was just a battle, you know, that, you know, it had its rewards, obviously. And it's fun to see now how well everybody has done. But that program did have its trade-offs,
yeah.
You know, with trying to get quality product, useful footage, you know, well-edited videos from somebody who was that inexperienced. But by the time they left, if they worked hard, they knew enough to get a good job in the hunting industry, which, you know, and that's what it took. You know, they just had to be committed to it. And if they were committed to it and they didn't really worry about how many hours they had to work, they were going to come out of there with a good job somewhere.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool.
I feel like it's got to be a special candidate. There's a difference between just a filmmaker and someone that's got to sit out there during the rut all day for seven straight days and still be able to perform.
It's even worse than that, because when they get done sitting out there during the rut, then they got to come back and edit.
Yeah.
Before they go to bed, because of our you know, spontaneous nature of our content. You know, most of the film companies back then, all of them back then, you know, the cameraman would just go back to the camp and eat dinner and go to bed or laugh and hang out with their friends. But at Midwest Whitetail, they went to work when the hunt was over, because we had to produce an episode the next day. And, you know, I told them, I don't really care how much you hunt, but you've got to get your work done. So the work comes first, you know, so you're welcome to hunt, but that's not an excuse for why you didn't get the work done that we need you to do. So they were just burning the midnight oil. I mean, those guys would hunt all day and work all night, and I don't know when they slept, but they'd be in the office at 2 a.m. editing sometimes and get up at 5 and go hunting again. It was crazy.
So you would let them hunt on your farm and kill deer?
Because they were hunting public land in Southern Iowa, you know, during the free time that they had between, you know, editing whatever episodes they were responsible for, they would go hunting. Well, they had private land properties to hunt too.
Okay.
But, you know, obviously the audience was fascinated by the public land stuff, so they ended up kind of gravitating more towards that.
Okay, gotcha. Well, we're creeping up here about over an hour. I know you got stuff to do, so we appreciate you coming on. I'd like to get you back on here late season, recap the season and stuff, because, you know, I think it's cool how, you know, Jordan's kind of taking on that thing with you on the YouTube channel, and we always thought it'd be Drew, but it's Jordan that's kind of took that over, and it's cool to see y'all come together and kind of continue this journey.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that, and just kind of stay in contact, and we'll see how the time works out for us after the season.
Okay, good deal. We appreciate it. Good luck this season.
Okay, you too. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Bye.
Yep.
Recording stopped.
We good?
We good?
Yep. Good on my end.
Good?
Good on my end.
Thank you, Bill, for joining us. I know. Yep, my pleasure. Well, you guys have a good day. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Bill. Have a good one.
Yeah. See you later.